you a great week ahead.
This is VOA News, reporting by remote. I'm Joe Ramsey. Canadian police threatened Wednesday to arrest trucker-led protesters who have shut down central Ottawa and disrupted cross-border trade in anger at COVID health rules, as Prime Minister Justin Trudeau called the movement unacceptable. With more people joining the blockade of the Ambassador Bridge between Windsor and the U.S. city of Detroit, in solidarity with the two-week-long truckers' protest in the Canadian capital, Trudeau warned the action threatens the country's economic recovery. To the protesters, he said, quote, "You can't end a pandemic with blockades. You need to end it with science. You need to end it with public health measures." Several Canadian and American chambers of commerce and industry associations, in a joint statement, demanded the bridge be cleared, saying, quote, "As our economies emerge from the impacts of the pandemic, we cannot allow any group to undermine the cross-border trade." New Zealand police on Thursday arrested more than 50 people and began forcefully removing hundreds of protesters camped outside its parliament building for the last 3 days to protest COVID-19 vaccine mandates and tough coronavirus restrictions. Inspired by truckers' demonstrations in Canada, several thousand protesters this week blocked streets near the parliament in capital Wellington with trucks, cars, and motorcycles. A country of 5 million people, New Zealand has reported just over 18,000 confirmed cases and 53 deaths since the pandemic began. About 94% of eligible people are vaccinated. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern on Thursday told the protesters to, quote, "move on," saying the protests are not a reflection of what the majority in the country feels. This is VOA News. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin spoke on Wednesday with the defense ministers of South Korea and Japan about the threats posed by North Korea after missile launches by Pyongyang, the Pentagon said. International tension has been rising over a series of North Korean ballistic missile tests, actions long banned by the U.N. Security Council. January was a record month of such tests with at least 7 launches, including a new type of so-called hypersonic missile able to maneuver at high speed. Quote, "The leaders emphasized that the DPRK's ballistic missile launches are destabilizing to regional security and a clear violation of multiple United Nations Security Council resolutions," Pentagon spokesman John Kirby said in a statement, using the acronym for North Korea's official name. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki on Wednesday repeated warnings made earlier by U.S. President Joe Biden that Americans in Ukraine should leave the country. Psaki said the State Department had assessed in October that around 6,600 Americans were in the country at that time. U.S. officials say that with more than 100,000 Russian troops nearing Ukraine's eastern and northern borders, the threat of a Russian invasion is more serious than others that have come and gone during the years of fighting between Russia-backed rebels and Ukrainian forces. President Joe Biden had said it would be wise for Americans other than essential diplomats to leave Ukraine and has ordered the deployment of 1,700 troops to neighboring Poland. Psaki said the situation facing Americans inside Ukraine was not similar to the mass evacuation after the fall of Kabul and Afghanistan. Tunisian President Kais Saied will change the Supreme Judicial Council but not abolish it, the justice minister said on Wednesday, days after the president stated his plan to dissolve the body met intense criticism, including from Western donors whose help is needed to avert a crisis in public finances. The president, however, said later in the day that he rejected so-called foreign interference, following the widespread criticism after he announced plans on Sunday to dissolve the body that guarantees judicial independence. Tunisia's justice minister said on television that Saied would maintain the council as a constitutional institution, but change the law regulating it and set up a temporary judicial authority in the meantime. Critics, who include judges, rights groups, and opposition parties, said abolishing the council undermines judicial independence and could help Saied cement one-man rule. Reporting by remote, I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Today is Thursday, February 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinua Adofo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, NATO says thousands of troops from 20 member states have deployed in Eastern Europe as top British envoy arrived Moscow.
NATO's enhanced forward presence also shows that our alliance can adapt to meet any challenge at any time. And this is more important today because we see Russia's continued military buildup in and around Ukraine.
More U.S. troops arrive Poland as the Pentagon mounts growing demands for assistance from Baltic nations.
There's no decision on how long that will be. I mean, rotational deployments can be anything from 3 months to 6 months. It varies. And clearly, this is being done because of the security situation on the ground.
And a look at the history and legacy of Islam in the United States. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. British top diplomat Foreign Secretary Liz Truss warns that a Russian invasion of Ukraine would mean, quote, massive consequences for all involved. Truss arrived Moscow on Wednesday to try to defuse tensions raised by Russia's military buildup near Ukraine. Moscow is demanding security guarantees from NATO and the West. NATO's Deputy Secretary General Miro Chagiona says almost 5,000 troops from 20 of the 30 members of the alliance have deployed in Eastern Europe in response to Russia's massing troops along its neighbors' borders.
NATO's enhanced forward presence also shows that our alliance can adapt to meet any challenge at any time. And this is more important today because we see Russia's continued military buildup in and around Ukraine and movement of forces into Belarus. So the risk of conflict remains real, and NATO continues to call on Russia to de-escalate. We are a defensive alliance committed to finding a political solution to the crisis, and we commend the diplomatic efforts underway. We also be always ready, if necessary, to protect and defend all allies from all directions and from all threats.
That's NATO Deputy Secretary General Miro Chagiona. Lithuania will ask the United States to permanently station troops in the country to help boost security, the Baltic nation's president said on Wednesday. Gitanas Nausėda spoke after welcoming a new rotation of German-led international NATO battle group deployed in 2017 and soon to include 350 additional German troops in response to Russia massing its troops near Ukraine. Since 2019, the United States has deployed non-overlapping rotations of its own group of about 500 troops and equipment in Lithuania, adding to the alliance's efforts to deter Russia from its vulnerable flank. This, as NATO's military committee chair said, the alliance will move more troops to the Baltics and Poland if Russian forces do not leave Belarus after the planned military exercise. As more American elite forces arrive in the region, I spoke with VOA's Pentagon correspondent Carla Barb on the duration of their mission.
There's no decision on how long that will be. I mean, rotational deployments can be anything from 3 months to 6 months. It varies. And clearly, this is being done because of the security situation on the ground in coordination with the allies that we're working with. There's some troops that are deploying to Poland, as I mentioned earlier, also to Romania. And then some more are going to reinforce the numbers that are already in Germany. So all of this is being coordinated with the NATO alliance and with unilaterally with these partners. And based on their needs and based on the security threats from Russia, that's going to dictate how long these rotational forces are there. I mean, should Russia pull out its forces next week, I don't really see a need for these troops to be there, and I don't see them staying any longer. But if Russia continues to build up their troop numbers, as they've done, in fact, Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby told us just minutes ago that Russia in the last couple of days, in the last 24 hours, has continued to add more troops on the borders with Ukraine. If that continues, then those troops are going to have to remain.
There continues to be demand for both U.S. forces and equipment from either the Baltic states, from Ukraine, Poland, and surrounding areas. Has the Pentagon set a limit as to what it can do and what it can provide?
Oh, no. But remember, this is a very fluid situation. And so we won't be getting details immediately. These will be details that will be trickling out in the next days and weeks and possibly even months, depending on how long this thing is going to go on. I will say that Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin is going to be attending the NATO Defense Ministerial in Brussels next week. VOA was the first to report that he would be attending the in-person event. And I am sure that is going to be a topic of discussion with all of the defense ministers and the defense chiefs there that are interested. They want to know what can the U.S. provide, because the U.S. is the largest member of NATO, and what additional equipment, what additional weapons, what additional troops they can provide. And the Pentagon doesn't like to talk about troop numbers. They like to talk about capability. So when they deployed these units, they deployed these units because these additional capabilities were requested. And then based on the capability needed, they can form in their mind, how many troops do we need to support that? And they do that. They definitely won't be just adding random number of like 5,000 troops to one country or 10,000 troops to another country or 1,000 troops to another country. It will be based on the capabilities that each individual ally needs, as well as the capabilities that NATO overall as a force needs on its eastern flank.
Ukraine officials confirmed today receipt of more U.S. equipment. From the Pentagon point of view, do we know what they are getting?
Oh, yeah, we definitely know. There's been over a half dozen shipments that are going to Ukraine. We know that they include everything from ammunition to javelins, things that can help shoot down incoming fire. We also know that they're receiving things like medical supplies as well. We've been pushing the Pentagon to get more specifics on that, and they have taken that question from VOA, and they should get back to us in the coming days.
That's VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Bob speaking with me from Washington. As efforts to calm tensions between Moscow and Kyiv continue, civilians along the border are planning what they will do if Russia invades Ukraine. For VOA, Olena Damenko spoke to residents in the Sumy region of northeast Ukraine in this story narrated by Anna Rice.
40-year-old Yulia Vitkovska is a nurse and reservist for Territorial Defense Forces in northeastern Ukraine.
Being some 50 kilometers from the Russian border is not far. One full salvo from a BM-21 Grad and the city of Sumy is in ruins. What should I do? Sit in these ruins and wait for someone to come and save us? No, no. If there is a need, I'll do my best to get my family out of here. My mom is elderly and she is sick. My son is a student. I'll make sure they leave, but I'll stay. I don't want to leave my home for some occupant to live here.
Activist Andriy Bukin says she's not alone.
Two-thirds of my friends, if not more, will protect our Sumy region and the city through either official or volunteer organizations. The issue is especially acute if the little green men show up, just like in 2014 in Crimea.
This is Kostantinivka, one of about 30 cities in the Sumy region near the Russian border.
Over there, on the other side, you can see where vegetable patches end. There's Russia. People's vegetable patches stretch right up to the border.
Mykola Taranyuk is chairman of the Khatyn Amalgamated Territorial Community, which includes 10 local villages. So far, he says, there hasn't been much activity.
Sometimes we see planes pass by, small ones, maybe border forces. At times, I can see our planes as well as theirs. It's been quiet.
Still, people are anxious.
People aren't leaving, but you can feel the tension. They used to talk about gas, rising food prices, politics. And today, whenever people meet, by a store or anywhere else, they always say, well, have you heard anything? Is there going to be war or not?
Local officials say there is talk about increasing the number of military forces in the Sumy region.
Together with the Ministry of Defense, we're discussing the possibility to have one or two more brigades here. Over February, we'll hold drills for the Territorial Defense Forces. It'll be a full-scale drill.
But Yulia Vitkovska says they aren't as prepared as they should be.
I don't see the appropriate response from the structures that need to deal with this in such a difficult time. It's impossible to learn during one or two drills.
Vitkovska now plans to start civil defense courses together with some of her friends as they continue to prepare for an uncertain future. For Elena Adamenko in the Sumy region, Ukraine, Anna Rice, VOA News.
The International Committee of the Red Cross says it is delivering urgent assistance to both Ukrainians and Russians living near the border as the combination of sub-zero temperatures, COVID-19, and chronic uncertainty with the Ukraine crisis make basic needs a challenge. In the second part of their two-part conversation, VOA's Carol Van Dam asks Oleksandr Vysenko, spokesperson ICRC Ukraine delegation, if the Russian and Ukrainian people are helping each other along their border.
People helping each other, otherwise they can't survive because there is no electricity there for 2 months already. After the last shelling in November, the electricity had been cut and they have no electricity, and it means there is no water supply because of centralized water system. And they have to melt the snow for drinking water, just for you to understand how hard it is. And of course, COVID pandemic is also very dangerous for them because if it comes in this vulnerable place, there is no doctor and no possibility to get somewhere. The village is about 6 kilometers for a walk. And for people over 80, it's very hard to get there.
Well, it sounds like you've been right there, at least.
Yes, I was there last week, yeah.
How afraid would you say people are that Russia is actually going to invade Ukraine?
There are many things that trouble them most. So this COVID situation, because during COVID pandemic, they find themselves in such vulnerable position as they were in 2014, 2015, because transportation had been stopped. No places for purchase because all the things have been restricted to work, and for example, for school as well.
What I gather is that they're just more afraid of being able to get through the day and basic survival than they are an invasion.
Exactly. Or, for example, distance education, which is also a nightmare for those people because if you don't have Wi-Fi connection, it's probably for 90% of people living there. And it's very hard to organize a distance education, and people just, and students just spend time for nothing in their houses without getting any education. So for them, it's all these things, which could sound like some ordinary things, but they bother them much more than possible escalation.
That's Oleksandr Vysenko, spokesperson for the ICRC Ukraine delegation, speaking with my colleague Carol Van Dam from Kyiv, Ukraine. An international humanitarian official warns a war in Ukraine will be cataclysmic, potentially engulfing neighboring countries and turning it into a regional conflict. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, Jan Egeland, just spent a week along the government side of the front line that separates Ukrainian armed forces from the Russian-backed rebel-held regions of eastern Ukraine. He went there to gauge people's views on a possible Russian invasion of Ukraine. He says people overwhelmingly agree it would be utterly insane to launch another cataclysmic war. He says they told him it would be senseless beyond belief.
And they said, listen, this is completely surreal for us. They feel that they are hostage now to some kind of a geopolitical chess game that is engulfing them. And none of the people who make the decisions will suffer. They will suffer, and they have no part of it.
Ukraine has been involved in a simmering war for the past 8 years. In 2014, Russia invaded and illegally annexed the Crimean Peninsula. Soon after, Russian-backed separatists took up arms in the Donbas region. About 2 million people live along the 20-kilometer contact line that separates government and separatist forces. Egeland says most of the young people have left the area, leaving an aging population of poor pensioners behind. He says it is they who will be the victims if war breaks out.
You cannot have a war among hundreds of thousands of freezing, miserable pensioners on both sides. It is vulnerable communities with babushkas that I met in their 80s. who really would be taking in the first of the fighting.
Egeland warns war would displace around 2 million people just along the contact line. He says a war also would trigger a massive refugee exodus, with most people fleeing for safety to Russia and Poland. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In other news, SpaceX's newest fleet of satellites is tumbling out of orbit after being struck by a solar storm. The company reports that up to 40 of the 49 small internet service satellites launched last week have either re-entered the atmosphere or burned up or about to do so. SpaceX says the storm made the atmosphere denser, which increased the drag on the satellites and doomed them. Ground controllers tried to save the satellites by putting them into a type of hibernation and flying them in a way to minimize drag, but the atmospheric pull was too great. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu in Washington. When American students think of Islam, they might recall an image of Denzel Washington playing a stern and passionate Malcolm X in Spike Lee's 1992 film, or maybe they imagine Louis Farrakhan on the speaker's platform at the Million Man March in 1995. But American Muslim history is longer than most might think, extending back to the day the first slave ship landed on Virginia's coast in 1619. Reporter Angie Omar spoke with Thomas Tweed, professor of history and American studies at the University of Notre Dame, on how the history of slavery in the United States revealed the beginning of African Muslims' arrival to America.
Although it wasn't part of the original early stories about the history of slavery or the history of the United States, we now know that a significant number of African slaves to the Americas and to what the lands that are now the United States claimed some kind of African, some kind of Islamic heritage. People debate how much, but a significant portion for sure.
How has African-American Islam addressed race relations since the 1960s?
People are very interested in African-American Islam since the 60s, but some of the earlier things about the history of slavery in Islam probably need to be said before we go on to that, namely that the first African slaves to walk on the land that's now the United States came before 1619 and the first slaves to come to Virginia. The Spanish brought them, and including one of the party from the late 16th century of Spaniards who got lost and walked along the Gulf. It seems to have been Muslim, and there were other Spanish heritage Muslims there too. Since the 60s, Islam has played an important role in the American imagination, and African-American Islam addressed race relations since the 60s in a number of ways. One of the most fundamental ones was that it provided a kind of a religious alternative for a number of African-Americans who were, for various reasons, disillusioned with Christianity. It offered some of the same things they were seeking about self-improvement and salvation, but it seemed to have a model of better relations across religious traditions.
How did the African Muslim American society contribute to the United States?
I think it contributed in lots of ways. Malcolm X's contributions were enormous, especially his testimony of its colorblind character, that there could be a religious tradition that was blind to racial differences. Muhammad Ali's embrace of Islam shaped global and local perceptions of Islam. And there were a less known fact, there were conscientious objectors during the Vietnam War who were affiliated with African-American Islam, who claimed that they could not fight in that war and that their Islam was a religion of peace.
That's Angie Omar speaking with Thomas Tweed, professor of history and American studies at the University of Notre Dame. After years of deteriorating relations, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is inviting his Israeli counterpart to visit. The invitation signals a rapprochement that observers say is driven by powerful mutual interests, including concerns over Iran's nuclear program and the future of oil and gas imports from Russia and Iran. For VOA, Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
A decade-long deep chill in Turkish-Israeli ties has been felt perhaps most deeply here among Turkey's small Jewish community. Thousands have left for Israel and Europe in the face of constant attacks by pro-government newspapers alleging Jewish conspiracies. But Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's invitation to his Israeli counterpart Isaac Herzog to visit Turkey is seen as part of efforts to break his country's regional isolation and could, say analysts, lead to a reset. Soli Uzel teaches international relations at Kadir Has University in Istanbul.
It turns out that Turkey cannot really continue to be alone, that it cannot have bad relations with almost every country around it. And there is no doubt that the Turkish side is very eager to repair relations. And as I said, more surprisingly for me, the Israelis are also jumping in the field without preconditions.
In 2018, Turkey withdrew its ambassador and asked Israel's representative to leave in a protest gesture against the U.S. recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital. Turkey's strong backing of the Palestinians, especially hosting Hamas militants in Istanbul, has been a key point of tension. But analysts say Ankara is taking steps to address Israeli concerns. Asla Aydintashbash, a senior fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations.
There have been months of negotiations, more than a year, I would say, and Turkey has already curtailed activities of the more militant wing of Hamas.
Turkey shares Israel's concerns that Iran's nuclear program could be weaponized, and observers say that could provide important common ground. That is the view of Galia Lindenstrauss, an Israeli foreign policy specialist at the Institute for National Security Studies in Tel Aviv.
Of course, also Turkey doesn't want to see a nuclear Iran, but it's not. But Iran doesn't threaten Turkey that it will wipe Turkey off the map like it does to Israel. So it's a different level of threat. But if Israel will relax tensions with Turkey, then there is more room to concentrate on the bigger threat. I think that's where relaxation of tensions with Turkey can help.
Erdogan also sees Israel's vast natural gas fields, discovered only in the last few years, as a potential source of cooperation, given Turkey's energy needs. Mehmet Ergutcu is an analyst at the London Energy Club, a grouping of government and energy sector leaders.
Turkey actually needs gas, and is, I think, the Leviathan gas field, which is slated for export, could be an answer to that. It will also improve relations significantly and break Turkish isolation in the East Med.
Despite years of rising tensions, bilateral trade between Turkey and Israel has continued to boom, and observers see a pragmatic approach as the best chance for a return to a more normal relationship. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel. Coming up, a conversation with Congresswoman Elaine Luria, a Democrat from the state of Virginia. We will talk with Luria, who is a member of the Armed Services and Veterans Affairs Committee, as well as the Special Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol, about a wide range of domestic and foreign issues facing the nation. That's Press Conference USA this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis. Join me and a panel of journalists as we discuss the top stories of the week, including just after meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin, French President Emmanuel Macron traveled to Kiev for talks with Ukraine's president as leaders and diplomats work to de-escalate tensions along the Ukraine-Russia border. Join us for Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel. President Joe Biden says the United States removed a major terrorist threat to the world, referring to the leader of the so-called Islamic State, Haji Abdullah, holed up in northwestern Syria. My two Middle East analysts, Jennifer Caffarella and Brian Katulis, talk about the significance and ramifications of the raid and what his elimination means for the future of the terrorist group. That's Encounter this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu Afo in Washington, wishing you a great day.
This is the Voice of America, Washington. Ba ba bo zip.